Merkel announced on Monday she would not run for re-election as the leader of her party, the CDU, or Christian Democratic Union. Her decision comes one day after regional elections in Hesse, where the parties forming the Chancellor's Grand Coalition suffered major losses. The CDU and its partner in the German government, the SPD, Social Democrats, found themselves excluded in the region, where the Greens and the extreme right-wing AfD, Alternative for Germany, won the most votes. The elections in Hesse came 2 weeks after the Grand Coalition parties received a similar drubbing in regional polls in Bavaria. Nonetheless, German media has reported that Ms. Merkel also said she intended to remain in her office until the end of her mandate in 2021. Her 13 years as chancellor have piled up baggage from repeated compromise-laden grand coalitions with the SPD, as well as her 2015 decision to keep Germany's borders open during the peak of the refugee crisis. In that time, Germany allowed in more than 1 million migrants. The anti-immigrant AfD is now the biggest opposition party in the Bundestag and has seats in all of Germany's state parliaments. We begin with updates on the war in Yemen, which has produced what the UN calls the worst humanitarian disaster in the past 100 years. U.S.-backed, Saudi-led airstrikes in Yemen have not only caused tens of thousands of casualties, but have destroyed infrastructure, hospitals, plants, schools, and food supplies, resulting in famine and a cholera epidemic. While the repeated figure given in the media for casualties in Yemen since the Saudis began their air campaign in 2015 is 10,000 dead, analysts at the independent Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, once based in Sussex University, puts the figure at 56,000 dead, and only since 2016. This figure does not include deaths from malnutrition or cholera, which the UN says puts at risk more than 22 million people. Patrick Coburn, Middle East expert and correspondent at the British daily The Independent, cites this research, which puts a projected death count of between 70 and 80,000 people dating from the start of the Saudi-led airstrikes in March 2018. The number of victims in the war in Yemen, and again, only direct war deaths, not collateral, is growing by 2,000 a month as the fighting intensifies around the seaport of Hodeidah.
If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Suggested for mature audiences.
What we are seeing, just as we saw young, displaced, evil, or sick, or just plain losers be radicalized by ISIS, we are seeing the same thing in the United States right now. These two losers, these two sick people, these two evil people, three evil people, being radicalized by this right-wing propaganda industry. And that's exactly what it is. This whole caravan in the last week of the election is a giant lie. This is Trump's Reichstag fire.
Yeah.
It is a lie. And that the United States military, the most powerful armed force in the world, would be deployed at a brigade size unit level to the southern border to stop this caravan, which is 1,000 miles away and made up of women and children. The insinuations that it's filled with terrorists and Middle Easterners. 40% of the country has opted into an alternate reality. We have to wake up in this country and understand the danger that this presents to all of us. We can't put our heads in the sand. Kellyanne Conway despicably today goes on national television. She said, well, this shooter's motives were because there's an anti-religious sentiment. No, ma'am. The propaganda industry that she commands with the vile president that she serves, abetted by Mark Levin and Rush Limbaugh and Breitbart and Newsbusters and Judicial Watch and all the rest of them, have blood on their hands for the incitements that they have made that have triggered and radicalized these crazy people. It is deliberate in intent. He scapegoats minority populations. He alleges conspiracies. He creates a sense of shared and virtuous victimhood, positions himself as the avenger, and there is no cost too high, yeah, so long as it benefits his narcissism, so long as it benefits him politically.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Rindigina.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginal.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Inteligente de Indigena.
Last week, when Carly Fiorina, the former presidential candidate for the Republican Party, declared that Donald Trump has brought politics to a new low by referring to Stormy Daniels as horseface. Horseface. That's where we're at now. Is it horseface? You know, I'm not even annoyed. It's worse than that. I'm accustomed. I'm accustomed to it. Think about what that means. It means that when the President of the United States, the most powerful man on Earth, the Commander-in-Chief of the largest military might in history, makes the kind of statement that you'd expect from an unimaginative toddler with a grudge, we all just shrug and move on. Horseface. He looked at Stormy Daniels and he thought, she's got a face like a horse. I'll call her Horseface. That'll show her. Imagine being that unimaginative. Just think of all the witty, caustic put-downs in the history of politics. Churchill calling Clement Attlee a sheep in sheep's clothing, or Harold Wilson saying that Tony Benn is the only man I know who immatures with age, or Frank Dobson remarking that when Edwina Curry goes to the dentist, he's the one that needs the anaesthetic. You know, it's got, even Boris calling Corbyn a mutton-headed old mugwump shows a degree of creativity. But horseface? My son would think twice about calling someone horseface. And I know it's funny. Trump is the president. He's got all this power, but he's also got the mind of a child. It's funny. He's like Queen Elizabeth from Blackadder or the mayor in Family Guy. It's quite a funny comedic conceit, but this is real life. It's not a sketch, and that makes it kind of less funny. It makes it fucking terrifying, in fact. Maybe it's all just a strategy. You know, just a distraction from the real issues. Rather than a robust response to the Saudis killing and chopping up a journalist, let's just chuck out a few offensive tweets. Because he's been sucking up to that tyrannous regime for so long, he's not about to come out and have a go at them now, is he? So we can just expect more horse faces in the coming days, more inane tweets which quickly turn into clickbait. Because it works. And we know it works because I'm stood here reporting about it a week after he sent the fucking tweet. Scariest thing is, I'm not sure it's a strategy. Maybe, just maybe, he really is that fucking fit. Well, with the midterm elections just around the corner, the president is in full combative mode, taking to Twitter earlier today to berate the...
Hi, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Este es aborigen inteligente de radio.
Internet radio for smarter aboriginals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the fourth world from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salutan and peace to all the original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, welcoming to the people of the fourth world from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from the new Everyman Studios in the unceded Chinookan People's Territories, North America. I'm not even going to bother to get into it. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know what I'm talking about. If not, catch up. We're in new digs. I really don't know what the fuck to make of it. All thanks to Guadalupe's husband for rigging this up for us, but we lost the last studio, which is why we haven't had a broadcast, and we apologize. And I ended up doing it anyway, Lou. But you know what? Fuck the apologies. Today is Tuesday. What is it? October what? No, October, right? November 6th. And it's the midterms. That's all the fuck I know. I also know that a lot of us can't vote. So, you know, the fact that it's the November midterms kind of doesn't really mean anything to a lot of people who are dealing with racist goddamn police, who are dealing with the violence of the Proud Boys, who are sitting in the black urban centers of the United States that are dealing with violence from the fucking far right, violence from Patriot Prayer, you know, whatever the fuck they call themselves. You know, dealing with all this white racist goddamn terrorism in Florida, in the city of New York, in Philadelphia, in Portland fucking Oregon, in Seattle goddamn Washington, in San Francisco California, in Houston fucking Texas, in Miami goddamn Florida, wherever the fuck else in Florida, motherfucker runs into a goddamn yoga studio because he can't get a woman. Because he can't, with his arrogant Republican, white male, misogynist, admittedly so, fucking ass, can't get a woman for the obvious fucking reasons. Right? You know, he's a fat, out of shape fucking white guy, and he's angry with the fucking world. So he goes and he kills two people, shoots five others in an attempt to kill them, because as I pointed out to Ms. Angry Indian, my wife, He shot one of these women 9 goddamn times. That's not an accident. That's attempted fucking murder. Because he can't get a woman. Because he has a problem with black men, with Latino men, with Asian men, right? With indigenous men being with white women that he wants, but who are not interested in him. So he's angry with the entire fucking world. He's 40 fucking years old, but he's so goddamn juvenile in his mind. He looks as, what was he, 20-some-odd-year-old Lupe? Scott Rodiger? Is that how you pronounce his name? The one who shot up, he murdered 5 goddamn people before he committed suicide? And then this son of a bitch commits suicide. But, you know, here it is. You got black men that can't vote, black women that can't vote because they've been deemed felons. But white guys can go around and kill as many motherfuckers as they want. And we're supposed to forget about it and move on because, you know, this somehow, as Trump put it, took attention away from the midterm elections. You know, the MAGA bomber. A non-white guy. And I'm saying non-white in the fullest fucking sense of the word. He's Filipino and Italian. Italians are not white, ladies and gentlemen. Italians are not white. And if you're a listener of this program and you think that you're white because you're an Italian, you got another thing fucking coming. I mean, look at the goddamn history of Italy and Spain in terms of the Moors, in terms of fucking Sicily. And I mean, really? Really? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I was born in Newark and I grew up most of my goddamn time in fucking Philadelphia. How the fuck can you be Italian and claim to be white? What the fuck are you talking about? What the fuck are you talking about? How's that possible? How's that possible? You know, I mean, there's a bit of a claim now to Mediterranean. But, you know, even when you talk about Mediterranean, that involves Georgia, right? That involves what? You know, the entire Dalmatian fucking coast, Malta. You know, when we talk about race and racism, what the fuck are we really goddamn talking about? And why are we afraid to have that discussion? Well, we know why we're afraid to have that discussion, because it was the same problem that they were having in Rwanda, right? Between the Tutsi and the Hutu. You know, we want to put it all on the Belgians, but we can't. King Leopold did tons of goddamn damage. But what happened in Rwanda had to do with the Rwandan people, their fucking selves, all right? You know, as somebody who had to deal with, you know, Jamaicans hating Haitians, you know, disliking the Trinidadians. The Trinidadians fucking around between Trinidad and Tobago. Right, the Panamanians believing that the Guyana, you know, the people from Guyana were fucking full of shit and what have you, because they had too much fucking blood from South Asia. And then you had all the Chinese businessmen down there who were intermarrying. I mean, come on. How many Jamaicans had the last name of Chu? And Chong, right? And Wen and Wan. It's like, you know, come on, folks. It's bullshit. Okay? It's bullshit. And we can put it on white people as much as we want, the entire fucking blame. But you know what? It isn't really fucking discussing the real problems. Is it? You know, I'm a little confused here. Well, actually, I'm not a little confused. I'm completely confused. I'm confused, actually, with intelligent fucking people of color who continue to perpetuate the bullshit. You know, I mean, yeah, let's be honest. And I know people are going to call me on this. So, you know, the only way to fucking deal with shit like that is to be straight up from the fucking beginning. Yes, I'm part goddamn Jewish. And I've only really come to deal with that white man in my family because people have forced me to fucking deal with it. Colin Kaepernick is dealing with this shit. People are still questioning his blackness, even though he has done everything possible and lost his fucking career standing up for blackness, to the point where now he is working for Phil Knight and Nike, who as a corporation, and Phil Knight as an individual, has been giving it millions of dollars to the Republican Party that is being supported by the white racist fucking nationalism that Trump says he is down with. He has identified himself as a nationalist. Phil Knight is giving him millions of dollars, not a couple of hundred, millions of fucking dollars. Nike as a corporation is giving Trump and his supportive and the Republicans that are supporting him. I mean, how is she supposed to put it, Luke? This is a conundrum that black people fucking can't deal with. We refuse to boycott the NFL as a block, but and we have support Colin Kaepernick while insulting him behind his back, and he on the same time cannot get a job in his field, so he is taking money now from Phil Knight and the Nike Corporation, who is supporting Trump, who has basically called for Colin Kaepernick and all of the other black players who are supporting Take a Knee to lose their citizenship. Do you understand when I'm talking about hypernormalization, when I'm talking about confusion, and I'm asking myself, what the fuck the point? What is the point, Lupe, of your husband taking several fucking weekends of his personal time? Because I don't know a goddamn thing about carpentry, and he actually asked me to leave him alone, right? What I'm trying to say is, ladies and gentlemen, my dear listeners, because we don't ask you for a dime. We're not on Patreon. We don't ask you for fucking shit, right? Her husband, an Irish American who loves his motherfucking Latina goddamn wife to the point where he took his fucking personal time and went and got plywood and built a fucking studio to the specs of his wife's desires so that we could keep going with this motherfucking program. Because we lost our last studio because the Mexican man who has been in the United States more than three fucking decades, right? Like 34 fucking years that this man has been in the United States, has fought in the motherfucking United States Army, has done it all. Like my father, who told me one time, I mean, it was just a weekend, you know, we were just doing something together. He goes, you know, I served in the fucking military, so I can earn you your rights. He felt as a black Indian, he still needed to do more to earn me, his son, my goddamn rights. And then we have Trump here saying, I'm a nationalist, and I'm going to get rid of the 14th Amendment. The goddamn amendment that made it clear that black people could be fucking citizens, even if some of us as slaves were born in Africa. Because if you're a gullah person like me, despite how the fuck I look, if you're a gullah person like me, you more than likely have bloodlines that relate directly to Africa. We are the blackest, the gullah people are the blackest people in the fucking America. And it's not just because of bloodlines. It's because of who the fuck we are. We maintain our Africanness. I don't need to go around and say fuck white people to prove how African I am. But you know, in this climate, I have to, because I have somebody standing behind Trump, talking about blacks for Trump, waving a sign, blacks for Trump and build the wall, who looks like me, who obviously is an African, who is confusing the situation. There are war bonnet wearing Indians who are standing behind Trump after all of the fucking chaos, all of the nastiness, all of the fucking Indian hatred that was directed towards Elizabeth Warren, who we now know, unless you just totally goddamn reject science just because you just want to. The Cherokee Nation is a made-up goddamn nation. They ejected their black members out of pure fucking white racism that operates in Indian country that we do not want to fucking talk about, because the question then of the five civilized tribes and African fucking slavery has to be raised. the question of Stan Waddy fighting for the Confederates, the last motherfucker to give up, the non-white Native American who had his shit taken by white people who then fought for the same white people so he could keep his fucking black slaves, was the last motherfucker to give up. His units were the last to surrender when the white boys already gave up. When Robert E. Lee, who Donald Trump fucking went, you know, around and talking about was the greatest general. Not the Republican Grant. The GOP could not give credit to Grant for defeating the rebellion, for defeating the treason, who put out a field order that said that black people must be given land. No, we're not talking about that. We allow Trump to get away with giving credit to the traitor, to the white supremacist, to the motherfucker who left upstate New York, West Point, training to go down to Virginia, talking about my home is more important than me, you know, my people, my home. Motherfucker, you're a goddamn traitor. Anybody that flies the Confederate flag is a traitor to the fucking United States. And I'm a black Indian that has all kinds of issues with the United States, and we can talk about slavery, we can talk about Native American goddamn sterilization, but I'm loyal to my fucking country. I told you, I'm not a liberal in the sense that you motherfuckers understand this shit. I'm indigenous. It's completely motherfucking different. My fucking identity existed before the United States became the United States. If you look at me as a Native American, if you look at me as a fucking Gullah man, either motherfucking way, I was here before you, white man. You racist white motherfuckers. I was here before you. Even my Philippine blood, my Ilocano blood, was building the goddamn railroads before you mother, the majority of you racist sons of bitches, your fucking ancestors ever touched ground here. Running from famine and unemployment in Europe. So you fuckers can kiss my goddamn ass. And I wish that the black people who are listening to this, the native people who are listening to this, understand what the fuck I'm saying. The white brothers and sisters who are not crazy, who are listening to this, direct your animosity towards the people who are fucking causing the animus, getting angry with the anti-racist, the anti-fucking fascist, the women who are trying to fucking point out what the hell is going on here is bullshit. It's cowardice. And this is why Kemp and Trump and the rest of these fuckers are still in place. Because we're afraid of them. Gavin McInnes has gone on, what, Joe Rogan, right? How many of you motherfuckers listen to Joe Rogan? I mean, how many? He's gone on Joe Rogan. They've gone on TV and promised more violence. Have demanded more violence from the Trump camp. This is what I'm saying with Farrakhan, too. He's calling Jews termites. Now you got the synagogue attack. Are you really going to motherfucking continue to give him leeway? Are you going to continue to fucking talk the bullshit that I admittedly have tried to bridge these goddamn gaps myself? This is why when I say you have to understand why white people are defending Trump. It's the same thing when black people are defending Farrakhan. Oh, well, Farrakhan's doing so much good for the community. What good is he doing? He pontificates. That's the only good that he does. But he's pontificating for himself. The motherfucker was on the Alex Jones show. The motherfuckers had the white Arab resistance leader, Tom Metzger. They have sat face to face and talked. And when Farrakhan was simply, you know, just another member of the nation, right? When he was just another member of the nation, when he was still the charmer, okay? Because it was Malcolm X who told him he had to stop singing. If he was going to be in the Nation of Islam, then he started singing for the Nation of Islam. We've talked about this. When he was just Louis X, he was totally down with the Nation of Islam having links with the American Nazi Party, having links with the KKK in the United States. I'm not talking about the Philippine KKK. I'm talking about the Ku Klux Klan. The Nation of Islam is an extremist, racist fucking organization. And then on top of that, you know, Lupe let me know before we came in here that Brian Kemp is running a fucking false ad showing the jerk-offs that call themselves the new Black Panther Party, who are only, again, you know, they're standing around, you know, pontificating, profiling, you know, trying to act like they're going to do something. They ain't going to do shit. These motherfuckers are working with the Nazis trying to get open carry laws down. Okay? Trying to get open carry laws passed. Figuring, okay, well, the white boys get their gun, we get our gun, and we both fight for our racial separatist shit. And, you know, we get the women that we want. Because, you know, a lot of these fuckers on the black end with this are incels, too. They can't get women. You know what I'm saying? But nobody really pays attention to black-on-black violence. You know, black male on black-female violence. We're not going to pay attention to that. But there's a whole lot of incels in the black community, too. But understand where I'm coming from right now. I'm watching a video feed of Democracy Now!, and I'm looking at four, actually, natives. There's several natives here, but there are four natives back here wearing war bonnets who are standing behind Donald Trump. But while motherfuckers want to jump up and down about Elizabeth Warren, who is a goddamn native, is she a member of the Cherokee Nation? The bullshit Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma? No, she's not. Or the nation in North Carolina, right? Or the other nation of the Kituwa, you know? Because, I mean, this shit has gone back and forth. There used to be four goddamn Cherokee nations. Now there's three, right? And then you got, like, the Northern Cherokee Nation and shit that claims Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader or the House Senate Leader and shit for the Republicans. He's the Senate Leader, right? For the Republicans. He's got, like, $7.3 million in goddamn contracts. His family, from claiming a Northern Cherokee relationship when there's no such thing as a Northern Cherokee tribe. The entire question of their nativeness is totally fucking whatever. But have Native people, the same conservatives that jumped on Elizabeth Warren and who were making the same goddamn noise about black Indians, have they said anything about this Republican motherfucker? $7.3 million? Has Elizabeth Warren gotten $7.3 million from fucking claiming to be Cherokee? No. She didn't even get into school that way. There's no proof of that bullshit. But there's still Native people fucking arguing about this. This male bomber, the MAGA bomber, claimed to be Seminole. It's not Seminole. It's Philippine and motherfucking Italian. Did they really rag on that? No. Yeah, there's been a couple of articles, but has there been ragging on that? No. Jason Chaffetz has said racist shit about Indians. Have these same people said anything about that? No. I mean, don't get on a squeaky squall, sure. But have they said anything about Nikki Haley insulting all goddamn Native people? At the fucking U.S.? No. Have they said anything about Trump calling, you know, shit Pocahontas? Yeah, they didn't get mad, but had they gone after him the way they gone after Elizabeth Warren? No. So where are we at? Where are we aiming our animus here, folks? At the low-hanging fruit? Or are we going to go after the motherfuckers that are really doing this shit? This is the Angry Indian, and you are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Violent Fanone, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
From a new Black Panther Party rally in Philadelphia. Now, we want to make the point that the new Black Panther movement is in no way affiliated with the Black Panthers of the Civil Rights era. This is the original Black Panthers. And in light of the voter intimidation investigation, we thought that taking a look back at the 1960s movement would help us all put this in better perspective. Bobby Seale is a founding chairman of the original Black Panthers. He's joining us live from Oakland. Bobby, great to see you.
Good morning.
First of all, your reaction quickly, if you don't mind, to the cell phone video and these new Black Panthers standing there in front of the polling station. Do you believe that that was voter intimidation?
Yeah, to some degree it was. What happens is they misunderstood. They're supposed to have a candidate on the ballot or somebody they support that relates to the arguments for change that they want, and rather than having a club or something like that. And it's a misrepresentation, of course, of what we were about. I mean, I ran for mayor of Oakland. I ran for California State Assembly. We put party members on the ballot. Political electoral politics was part of our thing. We were some of the most profound grassroots community organizers in the country at the time for those days.
And I want to go deeper into that difference and the fact that you did run for office and you were so much about making change versus inciting hate. And I want to ask you, the new Black Panthers, they declined to come on air with you today. I want you to know that I did reach out, and they declined to have this discussion. So with that point made, how do you feel about the fact that they are building off your legacy? They even have your book, Seize the Time, listed as a book that new Black Panthers should read. In addition, they have a 10-point plan, just like you had a 10-point plan. They use a lot of the same language, except for one thing that I noticed. The Black Panther Party from your time, the Black Panther Party that you founded, said, all power to all the people. And that's what was listed in your 10-point plan. The new Black Panther Party plan uses some of the same language, but says, all the people of color have been subjected to the white man's wrath. I look at your 10-point plan, and I see a huge difference between that and the new Black Panther Party 10-point plan.
Well, our 10-point platform and program was about all power to people. We started in the African-American community. We became a profound organization, but our principles, we were never what you call xenophobic Black nationalists. We were not separatist Black nationalists. That was not the name of the game. I created this party. This organization came out of my heart, mind, and soul. It was Black community unity, yes, but only as a catalyst to help humanize the world. And every possible practical, progressive human being that wanted to help and work with us or work in coalition with us, other ethnic groups, other Asian, Native American, Puerto Rican, and others. This is what we had, coalition politics. We crossed all racial lines and ethnic lines. And we said all power to all the people, because really we was trying to get rid of institutionalized racism in America. And to run for political office is one method of trying to do that. And that's the way you want to try to get into political office, to change laws that's on the books. And this is largely what's happening. I mean, I have former Black Panther Party members. Bobby Rush is a United States congressman. Another person who was a community worker with the Black Panther Party was none other than Congresswoman Barbara Lee. I mean, and they stand up. These are stand-up people that we were fighting for constitutional, democratic, civil, human rights, economic parity, et cetera, okay, that we stood for in the 1960s.
Okay, so with that point, which is exactly the point that I wanted you to make, I want you to listen to King Samir Shabazz. He's the chair of the Philadelphia chapter, and he was speaking at a rally there. Take a listen to this, and I want to get your feedback.
We didn't come out here to play today. There's too much serious business going on in the Black community to be out here sliding through South Street with white, dirty, cracker whore on our arm, and we call ourselves Black men with African garb on. What the hell is wrong with you, Black man? You had a doom day with a white girl on your damn arm.
How does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, it's just that old xenophobic kind of rhetoric, you know, a xenophobic kind of rhetoric that turns into sort of a kind of a racist rhetoric rather than anything that's constructive. You know, we used to say the only true culture worth holding on to was really a people's revolutionary culture. In other words, re-evolving more political, economic, and social justice power back into the hands of the people. That's really what's necessary to be held on to, rather than making absurd racial categorical remarks That's not what it's about. You know what I mean? If they use my book, Seize the Time, they should read page 69. It says why we are not racist. I state there, and I stated in 1970 when I wrote the book as a political prisoner at the time, we will never ever stoop to the low scurvy level of the mentality of a racist just to hate another person just because of the color of their skin or their ethnicity. We don't do that. That's not what the goal objective. The goal objective is human liberation. The goal objective is a greater community cooperational humanism. The goal objective is to get rid of institutionalized racism. And for instance, being a great supporter, Barack Obama is a representative of us having gotten rid of a large aspect of institutionalized racism here in the United States of America.
And final thought, just looking back at some of the pictures on your website that reminded me of what you made happen, the free breakfast program, the youth institutes, the free ambulance service. Just looking back at these images, so different, Bobby, from the images we see within the new Black Panther Party. Are you concerned about how the new Black Panther Party is affecting your legacy and the good things you did, as you say, not only for the African-American community, but for all?
Well, the problem with the young people, you see, the new Black Panthers have been around since 1989 out of Dallas, Texas, originally. And the old Black Panthers there called me up. They're a bunch of PhDs and stuff. And said, Chairman Bobby, you got to do something and come down here and speak about these guys because they're distorting what we were about. So they don't understand this. So the new Black Panthers and their changed in form have never put up one of these kinds of programs. Now, the programs help unify the people in the community, unify the electoral power in the community. When you unify the electoral power in the community, then you're doing a heck of a lot more because you're going to the core. You're going to the law books. You're going to the city charters. You're going to the legislative framework that made the laws in the first place. You know, when Rosa Parks was forced to move to the back of the bus, there was a law on the books that said that. So the objective is to change that law, and that's the way you change institutionalized racism in America. Now, we got attacked, and we defended ourselves. I mean, I have 28 dead Black Panther Party members by the end of December, you know what I mean? But then steps in. Who steps in? United States Congress. Finally, we got Ted Kennedy and Senator Church to step in, and they put the FBI and the police on the hot seat about running around attacking all our Black Panther Party. After that, they were never ever many more shootouts in the Black community. And we went on to continue to run for political office, organize programs, get whole major institutions in our community, etc. That is what evolving human liberation is truly about.
Bobby Seale, founder of the original Black Panthers, not to be associated with the new Black Panther movement. What an honor to talk to you today, and what a great discussion. I really appreciate your time, Bobby.
Thank you.
Happening right now and coming into.
This is Radio Anguandia, Anguandian Radio for the Fourth World.
Your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCopFire.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Missy Elliott for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed, get tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
These are Manfred and Leo Friedman. They are my first cousins. Not distant relatives, first cousins. A few months after this picture was taken, 75 years ago, the Nazis put them on a train and then exterminated them, like vermin. They might have been saved if the U.S. had approved their parents' application to emigrate, but it didn't, because Americans thought Jews were shifty and dangerous. For some people in the White House, the Holocaust exists only in the history books. For the Jewish people, it is a collective national trauma. But along with Manfred and Leo and their parents, the Nazis murdered my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins, and countless other relatives. So for me, and for many other Jews, the Holocaust is still very, very personal, each and every day. Which is why I felt that, in recent days, the White House bashed my head in 3 times in a row. First, when President Trump's ban on Muslims brought back painful family memories of America's locked gates. Second, because the Holocaust is first and foremost about Jews. Manfred and Leo, along with 6 million others, were murdered because they were Jews, but the White House erased Jews from its Holocaust Day statement. And third, because White House spokesman Sean Spicer had the chutzpah to describe complaints about the omission as pathetic nitpicking and to proclaim that Trump had gone out of his way to mark Holocaust Day. In other words, the Jews should be grateful and shut their mouths. But I'll tell him what's truly pathetic. One, that the White House, hopefully out of ignorance, tried to minimize the centrality of Jews in the Holocaust, like some Holocaust deniers. Two, that its excuse for doing so is a perverse kind of political correctness of trying to be, and I quote, incredibly inclusive. Three, that rather than apologize or admit a mistake, the president's automatic response is attack, attack, attack. Four, that the administration still can't comprehend how much it hurts so many Jews, especially in America. And five, that Trump believes that support for Israeli policies or that a Jew was involved in writing the statement makes everything better. But I'll tell you what's really pathetic. That Israel didn't say a word. That Prime Minister Netanyahu and his ministers would have torn Obama apart if he dared do something similar, gave in to political expediency, cowardice, and just plain indifference. That was truly pathetic and hurtful and very, very personal.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery and murder. It is not a war of each against all.
Tune in to Subversion 1312, the 4ZZZ Anarchy Show.
Tuesday from 9 till 10 p.m. on 102.1 FM. Or streaming 4ZZZFM.org.au.
How about trying this future on for size?
I've been affected by gun violence over the years. It's through deaths of friends and family members and associates.
When I was 5 years old, I was held at gunpoint in a home invasion.
I've gone to the juvenile detention centers and I've met dozens of young kids. Babies, really, who have been affected by gun violence.
Directly, I've lost a few friends, but I think what why this touches my heart is having children of my own.
You know, I've been at parties where, you know, I had just left the party and, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, you know, I heard that, you know, somebody got shot and didn't make it.
There are a lot of people benefiting off of our pain, and it's time we do something.
I'm here to unload my investment because I think that it's important that we start kind of seeing where our money is going.
It's time to go to your financial advisor
and demand that there are no gun investments in your 401k.
Even if you don't have investments, you can still help spread the word.
This is something everyone can do.
So if you push your people to have 401ks, it might be your grandma, it might be your cousin, this effort can make a big impact.
I'm unloading for my loved ones that I lost.
I'm unloading for my 18-year-old self.
I'm unloading my 401k for the future of my children.
I'm unloading.
I'm unloading
for my family and their future.
I'm unloading so that my daughter can grow up in a safe, loving world.
Unload and join the movement.
Use hashtag I'm unloading to pledge your support for gun-free investing.
It ends because you decide. You make a decision that we don't want to just be feared in the world, but we want to be respected in the world. And you make a decision that we're willing to make the sacrifices and take the steps to avoid a melting of the polar ice caps and a drowning of the coasts all across this world. You make that decision.
So you must first of all remember that this system was not originally designed with black people in mind.
Right on, brother.
And it definitely was not prepared for black people to, in the end, begin to demand their rights and an equal share in this country, which they've died for. Hey, and we definitely are not going back to Africa. Once to exist in the system, we must first of all realize we've got to form our own black America within, but without white America. Already we've begun to do this with this little handshake that we got that they keep trying to copy and we keep improving on. And when they go and get their hair fluffed out, we braid ours. We're doing our own thing. We are free. We have, first of all, got to protect our brothers and sisters from themselves and from those within the community that would rip them up. We have got to do this. We have got to stop sacrificing our sisters to the streets and our brothers to the drugs. So now, we have got to turn that around and take from them. I believe in taking. Go to school and get that knowledge. But get it with that black awareness always. What I'm saying to you is that you've got to carry this right on and power to the people, and black is beautiful, and black is now, out into your homes. Talk to your little brothers and sisters. Talk to your mothers and fathers. Talk to the people that you can relate to and begin to lift this whole thing up on a total basis. We've got to side up to that sister, because that sister on the street corner is someone's sister. That little brother that thinks it's nice to be high, we've got to show him another alternative. We've got to take care of our present. We've got to take care of our future. That's how we begin to create a black America within, but without white America.
Thank you.
spiritually deaf, dumb, and blind? Why is everybody making progress, yet we seem to be lagging so far behind? Why are we mistreated? Why are we in this condition, stripped of our names, our language, our culture, our country, our God, and our religion? This training has been gotten through the preacher, and he has told us of a heaven way up in the sky that we can't enjoy now, but rather after we die. But all of the years that we're living, for us there's nothing but hell, pain, torture, and misgiving. Yet the Bible speaks of a heaven filled with material luxury, which the white man and the preacher has right here, so we see. So my friend, take it for what it's worth. Heaven and hell are just two conditions of life, and they're both right here on this earth. Check back into history, which rewards our research and tells us plainly that before the white man gained entry to the East, he was living in the caves of Europe on the level of the beast, eating the bark of trees and eating flesh raw, till God sent Moses to civilize him and teach him the law. Then following many of his explorers, he gained entry into Asia and Africa. From China, he took silk and gunpowder. From India, he took jute, manganese, and rubber. He raped Africa of her diamonds and her gold. And from the Middle East, he took barrels of oil untold, deceiving, raping, robbing, and murdering everything in his path. The whole black world has tasted of the white man's wrath. So, my friend, it's not hard to tell a white man's hell is a black man's hell. Before we came to America, we were living in the East by the Nile River, living in luxury, enjoying freedom, justice, and equality. We wore silken robes and slippers of gold. We were the wealthiest and the wisest people I'm told. Now we are the poorest of the poor. Nobody wants us at their door. So my friend, it's easy to tell, white man heaven is a black man hell. When the white man came to America, he told the Indian, I am your white brother. He said, red man, I'll treat you the best. Yet until he pushed the Indian further west, with his white woman and fire water, sex and lies, he stole America. The people of this nation,
is hooked up on a reservation. Oh, my friend, it's easy to tell that a white man heaven is a black man hell. Someone to work the land. His back was too weak. He needed you, black man. So he commissioned Sir John Hawkins to commit the world's most grievous sin, to take a man who's born to be free and bring him down to slavery, to sell a man as merchandise. On his body put a price. So my friend, it's easy to tell that a white man heaven is a black man
hell. Hi, this is Annie from Au Revoir Simone. You're listening to a Creative Commons licensed podcast.
Nicely played. Sachin is off the mark.
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
This is APNS Public Radio.
Soft peanuts. Thank you.
Welcome to Like It Is. In an earlier program that we ran as a special three-part series entitled A Decade of Struggle, we included an interview with a man who worked as an informer for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We didn't show all of that interview, however, because of time limitations. We do feel, nonetheless, that we should air as much as possible of that interview because of the gravity of the information it contains. This edition of Like It Is will be devoted solely to that end. The name of the informant that we interviewed is Dothart Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello. He worked for the FBI as an informer who infiltrated various black organizations during the 1960s. Ours is the only full-face on-camera interview that he has conducted thus far. Now, we interviewed him on two separate occasions, so for purposes of continuity, we've edited this piece, going from one interview to another according to subject areas. We began with his account of how he was recruited by the FBI.
I was a student at Sacramento City College and Sacramento State College. I was stopped in the parking lot one day by a special agent by the name of Frank. He told me a little bit about that he knew that I had worked in military intelligence and how would I like to work for him. And also that I knew certain people in the so-called black radical fringe that they would be very interested in finding different information out about. I told him that my term for military intelligence had been very short-lived, that I was not interested in them and I wasn't interested in him either.
By now this must have been 1968-ish.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The following month, I was going to school on a federal grant and also a VA loan check. My check didn't come down, either one. I had bought a oscilloscope for a television communications class that I was taking from a person that I didn't even know. He just had the oscilloscope for sale and it was very cheap, so I bought it. Since my checks hadn't came down, being a student, and I was taking like close to, I think, about 23 units, something like that. It was a very heavy course load. I couldn't work and go to school at the same time. So I decided I would take the oscilloscope down to the pawn shop, pawn it, and use that money until my checks came. I went down, I pawned the oscilloscope. As I came out, I got busted. Possession of stolen property. Seems that someone had broken into Sacramento City College and had stolen the oscilloscope along with quite a few other things.
So what happened?
Well, I was taken to court due to the a friend of mine, attorney in Sacramento that I had been working for. He intervened for me and it was broken down to misdemeanor possession of stolen property, which I was given 3 years summary probation for. Let me clarify this. Summary probation means that all you have to do is you write a letter into the probation officer every month and you say, well, I've been a good boy this month. Bye, you know. I got an offer for a scholarship at Los Angeles City College, which I took advantage of, and I started going to Los Angeles City College and UCLA in Los Angeles. Coming out of LACC from the school one day, I was met again by the same special agent who said that he wanted to talk to me, and the offer was still good about me working for him. Again, I told him no, I was not interested. Then, told me that I should be interested because it could help me with a problem that I had And I told him I didn't have any problems that I knew of. He said, oh, yes, you remember the possession of stolen? I said, yeah, well, that's summary probation, man. I just write a letter in every month. He said, oh, no, no, that's not summary probation. It turned out it's a felony probation for 3 years, which means you have to report in every week.
To bring it down to a nutshell, what happened?
What happened was that as far as they were concerned, it was felony probation now. And if when you jump probation, that means they can put you in for the rest of the term of the probation, which came to about 2 years and 10 months.
And so they threatened you with that?
Yes, they did.
Why didn't you stand up to that?
I called the probation office in Sacramento first. They told me a warrant was out for my arrest and that I was going to jail.
Did you have any particular fear of jail?
Yes. I don't like to be shut in. I have a very, very dark fear of being shut up anywhere.
How would they have known this?
The only way they could have known that is from my psychological profile when I went into military intelligence, which they take on all people that work in military intelligence.
So you bent and you decided to go to work for them?
Yes.
How would you say that most of those who are doing the same thing that you did have gotten into that behavior? The same way you did, they were coerced?
Coerced, pressure. Some can take it for, I think some do it, might do it for the pay, for the feeling of power. It's a natural syndrome for a powerless person given a pedestal where he can direct, or he can say, well, this man goes to jail or this man stays free. They get a feeling of security from it.
For the FBI, did you get an indoctrination or did you just start cold?
No, I got an indoctrination. It started off with camera surveillance, electronic techniques, and surveillance, shadowing, the obtaining of let's say letters, empty envelopes, instructions on how to go to somebody's garbage containers and pick out useful items. You'd be surprised at the things that they take out of a garbage can, by the way. I mean, anywhere from the leftover food from breakfast, just to know what this guy eats for breakfast, you know. When they become interested in a person or a group of people, they try to find out as much as they possibly can, psychologically and academically and social-wise. Who do they run with? Do they go to certain nightclubs? Does this one have a sex hang-up? Is the man impudent? You know, anything that can be used later on.
How long was this indoctrination process?
It lasts anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. What is the most sophisticated equipment that you use as far as eavesdropping is concerned?
The video setup, and also I work with the new, I think it's called parabolic reflectors for sound pickup. Mm-hmm. Very interesting piece of equipment.
How is that used?
Okay, it reminds you of a disc. Have you ever seen those radioscopes?
Yeah.
You know how they're a disc and then there is a
cone behind it, like
cone in the center, right?
Yeah.
Okay, these parabolic reflectors were just like that, except a smaller version, and you would point it in the direction of where you wanted to pick up the sound from.
And how far away can it pick up sound?
I think it was anywhere from the ones I use, from 200 to 500 yards.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Distinct?
Distinct, very distinct. You could be in a building. Like say we're here right now, okay? Okay, not the next building, but the building behind, let's say it's a little bit taller. Okay, I could point that parabolic reflector from there to this window, and I could pick up. That's how good it was.
Through the window?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the window didn't have to be open. window and it had to be open in the hall.
How does one go about tailing a person? Describe that. Is there a particular art? You say you have to be taught that.
Well, there is a particular art to it, but, you know, okay, let me state, number one, the easiest way is to get close to the person so you can run with them. You know, that's the best way. Okay, the second best way is a thing of called trial and error observation, where you would go around and you would follow this guy, let's say, from a distance of anywhere from a half block to a block, as long as you can keep him in sight. And then you find out certain locales or certain places that this man goes to every day. Now, if you can get a set pattern of places that this man goes to every day, you got him down. You got him down. That's what they needed to know.
So after a couple of weeks, you were ready to go to work.
I wasn't ready, but I went to work, yeah.
Do you know if this indoctrination period is more sophisticated today?
Probably much more so sophisticated, for the simple reason that they're probably more severe on them as far as rating is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because of all the disclosures that are being made against them. I think they're being very, very careful. And when they sink their hooks in, I think they're making sure that it is tight, airtight.
In your experience, did you ever see the FBI try to sway newspaper or media news?
Oh, hey, let me run this down to you. L.A. Times? L.A. Times, man. I went over there and picked up press passes from certain people over there. Let me see. Some people that work for NBC.
TV?
Yes, in Los Angeles. Used to get press passes to the bureau and stuff. Fact is, we used to get some camera equipment from there.
So a lot of this news film was probably turned over to the FBI.
Oh, sure.
Was definitely turned over.
Well, hey, they had a lot of reporters and well, you know, it was that old game of one hand washes the other. Usually an agent would prefer to meet the reporter on a one-on-one basis, you understand what I mean? Build a rapport with him, you know, go out to the press club, buy him a few drinks, you know, take him out to Hollywood Park, you know, for the races, you know, that kind of thing. Say, hey, Jim, you know, your paper's covering such and such, or your TV station's covering such and such. And, yeah, I just like a little bit more information than I've been getting. I need it, you know. It would kind of help me, you know what I mean? A personal favor. And if you do something for me, maybe I can do something for you, you know, in the future. Like, you know, when we're about to break a case, you'll be the first to know, that kind of thing.
What kind of work did you end up doing as an undercover agent? Were you doing espionage work or informant work?
Informant work and also what you would call illegal entries, selling of weapons, selling of explosives, arson.
You would sell weapons and explosives to these radical, so-called radical groups that you were joining?
Yes.
All right, where did you operate?
I was given a cover name, Ed Riggs. With that, I was also given a birth certificate stating that both my parents were a birth certificate and a records for a Robert Riggs and a Mary Riggs who were deceased.
And you lost all of your true identity?
Yes.
And you operated in California?
California.
What cities in California?
Los Angeles, Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley, Sacramento, Chino, San Bernardino, Santa Cruz.
Any other states since California?
Yeah. Chicago, Chicago, New York. Made two trips to Washington, D.C. Also, I better put in Seattle, Washington. That's very important, too.
How does the FBI coordinate this information? You were one of a number of agents who were doing this. How did they correlate and coordinate this flow of information? How many agents, let's start with that, how many agents were working in a given city like L.A. in the late 60s?
Jesus, we're talking about a lot of people. Like I said before, in the state, I would say 700 to 1,000. In Los Angeles, which was a large concentrated area of blacks, we're talking about anywhere from 300 to 400 people. San Francisco, probably the same thing. That's a large concentration of black people. Wherever there was a large concentration of blacks, or a large concentration of minorities. Don't let me only say blacks, because we're talking about the Chicanos and we're talking about the Chinese, too.
But among every ethnic group, there were ethnic groups of that group who could be recruited by the FBI to infiltrate their own.
Right.
Just want to get a sense of how much money American taxpayers were laying out for this kind of exercise. What was your salary?
When I started with the Bureau, I was making $200 a week plus expenses. When I left the Bureau, I was making close to about $800 a week, and also some expenses, too.
So it might run as high as $1,000 a week?
Yes. It's according to what assignments you were put on at the time.
And statewide, there were 750 agents.
700 to 1,000. It might have been more than 1,000 statewide. People are into a fantasy world when they believe that the Federal Bureau of Investigation finds out what it finds out through the method of scientific investigation, that the agents can just go out and they can plot a course and they can follow a man everywhere and they take notes and such. That's not the name of the game. The name of the game is find someone that is close to that man or can get close to that man or that group or whatever, and have him do the legwork.
So in other words, there obviously then would have to be more informants than agents.
Definitely.
What would the ratio be?
Oh.
10 to 1?
I think every special agent usually has anywhere from 6 to 7 what I would call prime informants or agent provocateurs. And then also, you have anywhere from 20 to 25 people per agent also that are not really what you would call the everyday informant or agent provocateur, meaning that that person is not on a steady payroll by the Bureau, but every once in a while they will go to that person for information.
What is your speculation on what recently happened in Miami? Would you suspect that there has been a number of agents or informants that have descended on Miami since that eruption?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And not only from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, too. You'll have people from military intelligence, military intelligence and the CIA, for the simple reason that they want to find out the CIA and the military intelligence people want to find out, is this anything connected with some kind of foreign agency? That's their prime objective. The Bureau wants to find out whether this was an organized type of mass movement that's going on. Are there leaders? Are there central people that started this? They want to find that out. Who was the one that was out there getting the group of people together and said, hey, let's go get this? You know, they want to know that.
How would you tell a member of a community that they might be able to spot an informant? How is that possible? Can you spot one? Or what should one look for? Let's say someone in Liberty City.
Well, it's like this. Informants come in all sizes, colors, and attitudes. There is no definite way, unless you can get hold of this telephone bill, and if you can connect the number with the Bureau office, then you got it. You know, but
the fact that they're not working steady and yet are able to eat and get around doesn't mean anything.
Not so much in the black communities. That's one of the hard things, because there's such thing as hustling, and some people are known as good hustlers. So so people don't tend to trip off of him. You know, blood, I don't know how blood did it. Blood probably did. He robbed somebody, or hey man, he's selling some weed or whatever. You know,
would it necessarily have to be a new face in the community?
No. Now, fact is, they tend to shy away from that. What they try to do is get someone that's already situated. It's much easier. Much, much easier. If they have what they call a prime informant, one that has been trained, that knows how to get into the group. Say he's with another group, and he's made a name for himself. Okay, and then there is a group that the Bureau is interested in. Well, what they would like for him to do then is use his rep from the other group to deal with it.
What do you base your conjecture or your statement that FBI operations and surveillance is more extensive today than it ever was? Why would there be? There doesn't seem to be the kind of organizations that existed in the 60s. Why would there be an even greater surveillance on the part of the government?
Well, you have to look at it from the standpoint that the Bureau looks at it. And to them, organization or no organization, as long as there's one or two people or a handful of people that still think in the mold of some of the groups in the 60s, then they will be watching them. You can believe it.
Then we moved into the area of budget, how the Bureau operates and manages its money.
The FBI has holdings in different companies. They have storefronts, businesses.
Wait a minute now. Why would they have holdings in companies, stock holdings in companies?
It's extra money.
Oh, you mean they get such a big budget and they may not use it in a particular year, so they invest in the stock market?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The Bureau could, if federal funding was cut off to the Bureau right now, it could still go at full budget, I guess, for the next, 5, maybe 6 years.
Is it for this reason that the FBI has been able to stand up against many other government agencies?
You have to understand the person that started the Bureau and his background, J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar made an agency that was answerable to nobody but J. Edgar. There hasn't been a president that would dare call the FBI out on the carpet. Why?
Why?
Number one, just like they do background or surveillance on us, I suspect they do it to quite a few people and up there in the Capitol. Senators, presidents, vice presidents. Everybody's got a skeleton in his closet.
And on top of that, he's rendered the FBI financially independent.
Yes. The allotments for their budget has grown bigger and bigger with each year. While I was in the Bureau for 7 years, the budget grew bigger and bigger. It's the thing that the money's not spent are always sent back to, you know, to the government. Okay, but if you notice, the Bureau never sends any money back. Never. It uses its total budget, which is almost unheard of, except for the CIA, and they do the same thing. I guess being super patriots, they always had to figure that someday maybe the government might become corrupt with communists and leftists and black and communists and minorities and whatever, and that the FBI would have to function on its own bravely by itself. So J. Edgar Hoover had the foresight to make sure that the FBI would have a little nest egg around so it could conquer these subversives, you know.
And work west. What groups did you infiltrate in New York?
In New York, it was the Black Panther Party, Queens section.
How far into the organization did you get, and how'd you do it?
What I did was, I was a member of the party already in the California area. All I did was travel up and say I was checking out the party in the Queens area. What happened was, though, I only stayed with that assignment for, 2.5 days. We found out later, we found out then that it was infiltrated heavily by the New York Police Department.
And there was no need for your services.
There was no need for my services.
Let's go back to the 60s. In the first interview, you touched on the fact that you were involved in some way in the robbery of arms from the armory, weapons from the armory.
Yes.
Give us the details and what just went down.
What happened was that the Black Liberation Army, was in need of weapons. This was relayed to my supervising agent.
By you?
By me. Okay. He said, well, why don't you go back to them and tell them that you have a plan to get some weapons?
What year was this incident?
I don't really remember.
Okay.
I don't really remember. It was early 70s, I know that. What happened was, well, I didn't live that far from the Compton Armory. It was right up the street. And what the plan was that I laid out to him, that on parade day they only had one guard at the armory, and it would be very easy to go in there and get the weapons.
What role did the Bureau play in allowing you access or to facilitate access to rip off these arms?
Oh, they worked out the whole thing. They made sure that that there were no guards, except for, I think it was... Was there one guard? I think there was one. No, there wasn't. There wasn't anybody, as a matter of fact. That was the thing that was that kind of made me nervous about the whole thing, because I said, damn, you're supposed to have... It looks kind of phony when you go to an armory on a military base that's located near the Compton Watt area, and there's no guard in there with the weapons?
This is by day or by night?
This happened during the day.
What time of day? Morning?
No. It was late afternoon.
So what happened? You went into the armory via... How did you get in?
What we did was...
How many?
It was 6 of us all together.
Okay.
And we cut the... there was a chain with a lock. We cut the chain, opened the gate, shimmied on in, got over to where the armory was, opened the door, nobody was there, took the weapons and split. But the thing about it was, the firing pins were taken out of the 16, the firing pins were taken out of the 60 caliber machine guns. The grenade launchers, they were ready, no doubt. They were in A1, nothing had been tampered with them. I couldn't understand that.
Why would the Bureau be interested in collaborating to allow the theft of these weapons, so that knowing that they were going to go to the SBA or the BLA?
Well, it's like this.
SLA, I'm sorry.
Well, you have to... There's a thing called a controlled situation. And what is meant by controlled situation is that you know who has what and what they intend to do with it. Then also, you can also have someone or something where you can exert a little pressure to make sure that they do such and such a thing. They don't deviate. And the Bureau was very into controlled situations.
So in other words, when they got these weapons, they could then be goaded or lured into getting into some activity that would make them vulnerable.
Right.
In other words, set up.
Right.
At this juncture, Perry began talking about a man called Elmer Geronimo Pratt, who Perry says is serving time for a crime he couldn't have committed.
You're going to allow a person like Elmer Pratt to sit up 9 years in jail for nothing. The man did nothing, except that he was a leader in the Black Panther Party, and they wanted him out of the way.
They?
The Bureau.
So, what happened?
Well, there was a murder, right? The murder happened in Los Angeles. Elmer Pratt was in Oakland, okay? Elmer Pratt was under 24-hour surveillance, both physical and SE, electronic. Okay? The Bureau, at any time after LAPD picked up Elmer Pratt, could have went down there and said, hey, look, you made a mistake. The guy was in Oakland. Okay? They didn't. They sit back and let it happen because they wanted the man out of the way. It's sick. Here's a man that got a Bronze Star and a Silver Star.
Pratt.
Right. Elmer Geronimo Pratt. So when he got out of the service, he joined the Black Panther Party because it was a cause that he thought was just and he thought was right. Possibly, and I'm not saying, don't let me paint him a saint, the man possibly did some things. But he did not commit a murder. You know? And let me tell you something about Elmer Pratt. And this is from personal observation. The man was honest. The man was upright. And his word was his bond. You know? And he wouldn't go around doing a jive-ass robbery on a damn tennis court and kill someone. That's just not Elmer Pratt. He was set up. He was railroaded from the get. I'm surprised they didn't try to kill him in prison. And I'll be surprised if they don't attempt to do it now. Because now people are starting to make waves. Finally, people are starting to realize after the man's been in there 9 years. And by the way, four years of that was in solitary confinement.
Was the Compton Armory the only instance where you supplied arms to liberation or black groups?
No. I supplied handguns, a few other things, quite a few people. The Community Freedom School, I gave them the ID, the money, and told them the store to go to purchase weapons. And what weapons to purchase?
Have you witnessed murder?
One. Fred Bennett.
Were there ties to the Bureau involved in this murder?
Well, let me put it to you like
this. Who's Fred Bennett?
Fred Bennett was a sort of low-ranking Panther Party member in Oakland. He was with the national headquarters. I found out later on that there was a great possibility or that he might have been really a informant, but of a very low caliber.
Well, what happened? What did you see?
Well, I went up in a Jeep in the Santa Cruz Mountains with Jimmy Carr, Fred Bennett, and myself, and some white guy. Also, I was finding out later on that the white guy was working for the Bureau also. Mosier, I think his name was.
What happened?
Anyway, we get up there to the mountain, and Bennett says, you know, we got an informant here.
In the car?
In the car. And when he said that, the first name that clicked through my head was, excuse the expression, Jimmy Carr was not one to be trifling with. The brother had been in and out of prison all his life. For him to cut somebody's throat, or to possibly physically beat them to death would have been no problem. He was a big, big brother. The only thing that I could think of, well, the man's hands was on the steering wheel. Let me try to take his head off, or he takes mine off. I was armed also.
So what did you do?
I jumped, and I said, hey, what you talking about, man? And that's when he pulled his .357 and he said...
Carr?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm talking about Freddy. And what I thought was going to happen... Now, when he stopped it, he took him out. He chastised him, right? Slapped him around a lot. And then he took him up the hill. What I thought he was going to do was
you know, like beat the guy up severely, you know, break a leg, arm, whatever, you know, mess his head up a little chase, and then leave him out there. The next thing I know, me and Mosier, the white guy, we're standing by the Jeep, and we hear three shots go off. And then Carr comes down the hill, and he says, hey, you guys got to help me get rid of the body. And I'm thinking, oh, he killed him. That's, you know, but the thing was also, I was saying, play it like it is, you know, don't act like you're going to panic or anything, you know. So we went back up the hill. The white boy was greatly agitated. I mean, he's scared. I mean, excuse the expression. We went up there. He had almost actually decapitated the man. Have you ever seen a 357? Have you seen what he could do?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, his head was all, you know, like off. And we got some brush, some wood, and got some gasoline for the Jeep, and Carr poured it over the body and threw a match, and he burned the body up. And when I got back, I called up my supervising agent immediately and told him exactly what happened. And do you know they did not do a damn thing?
No. The car.
Nothing.
George Jackson was a member of the controversial Black Panther Party who was killed while he was in prison. Reports are that Jackson was trying to escape from prison when he was gunned down in the prison yard. Perry had some information about that.
As I recall, there was a good deal of public uproar about him being in the slams, and the chances were pretty good that he was going to get out because of this public pressure. If that's so, why would he be involved in such a sham attempt to break out of prison?
Okay, let me put it to you like this. I think that, okay, you have to understand the psychology of prison per se itself. Every inmate fantasizes about breaking out. Let me put it to you like that. After you've been there a year or so, you're going to be thinking about how can I get out of this place. The thing was, George Jackson thought that, and he probably thought correctly, that San Quentin officials under no circumstances were going to let that man walk away from that prison alive. Appeal or no appeal, probation or no probation. There are so many ways you can set a person up in prison, it's not funny. Yeah, I mean, they want you, they'll get you.
So not only because he hated the prison, but because his life was in jeopardy there.
Oh, yeah. More so that his life was in jeopardy. I was called by a group of so-called radical left in California to witness some fireworks up in Santa Cruz mountain area. When I talk about fireworks, I'm talking about explosives.
Not 4th of July.
Yeah.
What happened when you went to witness this testing of fireworks?
I took a Portapak unit with me, a Kai. I videotaped the sequence of how they used the explosives, who was there, you know.
What kind of explosives were they, actually?
They were, classic explosives, and it was a solution somewhat like nitroglycerin or nitroglycerin. Very high explosive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happened after that?
Okay, I found out through Carr and two of the other people there that this man was supplying this to them. I went back with the videotape to the Bureau, and I was later to find out that also worked for the Bureau.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the real purpose that this group was testing these fireworks? Did they tell you at the time?
For a possible escape of George Jackson.
Okay, so what happened?
What happened was that James Carr, who was better known as Jimmy Carr, who was like a second lieutenant to George Jackson, also was one of his former cellmates, was setting up a escape plan.
Right.
Okay. Now, the thing that is very confusing at this point to me is that through the information that I have and from the times that I spoke to Jimmy, they were setting up the works, but they hadn't put anything in motion. In other words, they had been slipping certain items into Mr. Jackson at present through different means. But the time wasn't right at the time that George Jackson supposedly made the attempt.
But at any rate, a plan then was for someone to slip this stuff into prison and get it to either Jimmy Carr or George Jackson to effect a breakout.
Oh, no, no, wait a minute. Jimmy Carr was on the outside at that
time. I'm sorry. Okay.
But it was slipped into George.
Okay.
It was slipped in.
Okay.
Because the same valve turned up after the so-called prison breakout. If you remember, the day of the George Jackson assassination, and that's what the hell it was, Vannetta Anderson supposedly went to visit George Jackson. I am saying Vannetta Anderson did not visit George Jackson. I am saying that guys, as a black woman, went to visit George Jackson.
Uh-huh.
And I am saying also that Stephen Bingham, the attorney, was used by the way of handing the tape recorder to Stephen Bingham, to Bingham, to take in, because there was no gun in that tape recorder. That gun was already inside there with George Jackson.
But apparently then, not only had the nitro and stuff been slipped to Jackson, but also there was a plan. And what was that plan?
Well, the plan that we knew about, or let me say, the plan that I knew about personally was the plan where they were supposed to blow the east wall of the prison. Jackson, in turn, was supposed to a chain, some long metal object, thrown it around the wires and grounded it. That's cutting out the power to the prison, and then escape off in the darkness with jeeps with armed people that Carr knew.
But what actually did happen?
What actually did happen? Okay. Now this is only a hypothesis on my part.
Yeah.
But what I think, since the present authorities and the Bureau were well aware of what Jackson was planning to do, that they forced his hand. Also, I believe that one of the guards had the 9mm pistol.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way in hell that George Jackson could have got that 9mm pistol smuggled in, because that 9mm pistol was confiscated over a year ago from Landon Williams during a raid. Oakland Police Department had it in their possession. It went from the Oakland Police Department to the Bureau, and from the Bureau it disappeared up until the time Jackson supposedly had that snuck in, where, you know, he hid it in a wig or whatever they said he did, whatever lie he came up with.
So you're saying then that George Jackson was given these vials that were actually duds, and then he ran out thinking that it was nitro, threw it against the wall, ping, they didn't go off, and he was blown away.
Right. And the thing that backs that to the max is that the brother that went out with him also had two of the tubes. But the thing was, the prison authorities put them in a basket, and they took the tubes out into the center of the yard, and supposedly they stood back from a long distance and shot their weapons at it, breaking the tubes and the contents. You know, the contents were all spilled out, and so there was no way to examine those. They did find one tube, and that was in George's cell. But no one's ever been able to get their hands on it due to some legal process brought down by the Attorney General's office in California.
What do you have to say about the Church Committee hearings? Do you feel that the Church Committee has revealed all the information that they've gathered?
No way.
No way. No way.
What percentage would you say they've released of the material from a personal viewpoint?
Personal viewpoint, I'd say about 10%, if that. That's kind of stretching it, I believe.
When you went to Washington to testify, you took a lot of evidence with you.
Yes, I did.
Physical evidence.
Yes, I did.
They kept that evidence.
Yes, they did.
Where is it?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
It was never made public.
No, it wasn't.
Was it strong evidence?
It was very strong evidence. I mean, how strong can you get when you actually have the voice of the man speaking to you over the telephone, instructing you after you steal certain particular paperwork to burn that garage up? And he says his name. Yeah. I think that's very strong evidence.
Well, what do you make of their reticence in releasing this information?
Well, let me put it to you like this. I think the whole thing was a farce. I think it was a setup. When I went up there, I was interviewed by some people from the Justice Department, which was cool. But then also they had two agents from the Bureau that interviewed me for an hour concerning the information that they damn sure knew about. You know. I think Church cooperated with the authorities to a great extent as far as holding back certain elements of things. You know, the Bureau has a good way of dealing with senators and congressmen. You know, when they try to release something on them, they say, hey, well, this file is still active, or this case is still actively going on, and if you release this pertinent information, then it will destroy the whole case. That kind of thing. So what is that called? There is a expression that they use for this. I'm trying to remember that expression. It's a little legal terminology in the interest of national security.
Hmm. We've aired these interviews in the hope that we've provided information and food for thought. It's not our purpose to characterize Mr. Perry nor judge him. If you choose, however, to pass judgment on Dothart Perry, it might also be appropriate to question whether or not each of us bears some responsibility for having allowed things like this to occur and continue to this very day.
You know you're going to go to prison, don't you, sooner or later? Or do you think you might get away?
I don't think I'm going to prison. I really don't think I'm going to prison.
Are you in fear of your life?
Not particularly.
How can that be?
It's like this.
I mean, all the characters that you've been running with, and now you're turning and talking about them, naming names. Somebody's got to get warm. This interview, full face on camera, is a good chance it's going to be seen nationwide.
Well, I take it like this. I've played the game this long. I'll play the game out. I think I have a little bit more going for me now than I had before. I think people are aware of the position that I was in and why I was in the position I was in. And I don't think the Bureau under any circumstances wants to put their hands on me. Fact is, I think they're going to be using most of their time denying that they've ever known me. Fact is, from when this stuff, when I first came out with it, that was one of the things. We'd never talked to him before. We don't know him. You know. Then later on it was a thing, well, yes, we know him, but he never worked for us. Then the third thing that came out was, well, yes, he worked for us, but he didn't work for us at the times he said he worked for us. I think they're more worried about people becoming aware of what's happening more so than me.
In your career as an informer, you committed arson, you witnessed murder, you stole weapons and supplied them to certain groups under false pretenses, you procured information from people. That's an ugly mirror to hang up in front of your face, isn't it?
Definitely. But then also, if you're thinking about the part of them pressing charges against me behind those actions that I did, you have to also think in part that if they're going to press charges against me, then they have to press charges against them.
How much would you say you've earned in your career as an informer? Have you ever thought about it?
No, not really. I would say anywhere in the seven-year period, I'd say anywhere between $50,000-$60,000.
Over a seven-year period?
Over a seven-year period.
It's not a lot of money.
It's not a lot of money, no. Per se, it really wasn't the money. It was the pressure. You'd be surprised at what a squeeze in the right place can do to a person. Because if you had told me when I got out of the service that I would work for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, I told you you were out of your mind.
And you're saying to our audience today that there are many, many, many black people, brothers and sisters, who are caught in the same bind that you were in.
Are worse.
And are working for the government.
Oh, yeah.
Informing on our people.
Definitely. The thing that really irritates me about this whole situation is that, of course, I know what I've done. You know, I'm well aware of that. I don't need to be reminded of it. But I think that black people in general need to be reminded of it because it's happening every day and it's happening in every city in this country. I doubt that there's a place between Alaska and California that is not happening to black people. But the thing that gets me is that black people are sitting back and they're saying, yeah, well, get him. Yeah, you can get me. Big deal. You haven't hurt them one iota. Fact is, you did them a favor, if you really want to get down to it. You did them an immense favor because you killed the cat that was pulling your coattail, and that's all they want anyway. You know, the thing is dealing directly with them. Use your lawmakers, your so-called prestigious community leaders to go out there and start questioning these people, letting them know that they're not going to allow this type of situation to happen anymore.
Are you saying then that too many black folks today are apathetic and laying back in the cut, but you don't see enough resentment to what has gone down?
Definitely, I'm saying that. If I was part of the madness, and it makes me ill, and it makes me angry, and I can go out here and do what I'm doing now, and these are the people that it was being done to, and they don't even give a damn, then hey man, what's happening? You know, you tell me, you let me know.
As far back as the 1920s, when he began as FBI director, Hoover had gone after persons like Marcus Garvey. Garvey's organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, had a membership numbering in the millions, and somehow Hoover found this threatening and worthy of surveillance and undermining attempts. Garvey's influence had been international and had drawn world attention to America's treatment of black people. Paul Robeson was another who was viewed by Hoover as an enemy. This reporter has personally examined thousands of FBI, CIA, and other U.S. government agency documents that were kept on Paul Robeson. Robeson, like Garvey, had an international audience at his command, and he used that platform to denounce racism in the United States.
Most importantly, however, were the questions raised by the State Department as to my political opinion. Here's a question of whether one who wants to sing and act can have, as a citizen, political opinion. And in attacking me, they suggested that when I was abroad, I spoke out against injustices to the Negro people in the United States. I certainly did. And the Supreme Court Justice just ruled, Judge Warren, in the segregation cases, that world opinion had a lot to do with that a ruling that our children, Negro children, can go to school like anybody else in the South. I'm very proud to have been a part of directing world opinion to precisely that condition. The second, that I fight for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. Bandung, the colored peoples of the world assembled and made it clear that nobody is going to tell them what to do. They're going to have the independence. I'm proud of that.
When the 60s came, many factions of the civil rights movement had developed the same international perspective.
Those of us living in the United States who see ourselves as, and who are in fact, you know, descendants of the Africans who were brought to this country, who were enslaved, I mean, and who are rebelling and revolting now against our oppressive condition, and we are concerned about Africa. We see Africa as our motherland, and we feel that we have a responsibility to speak with as much passion as any other African on this issue. The United States government says that change must come in South Africa through peaceful means. That same government has over 500,000 troops in Vietnam fighting not white people, but brown Vietnamese.
So it is small wonder that the civil rights movement was also subjected to heavy attack by Hoover. Billions of government dollars were spent in this direction. Many of these activities were not only unwarranted, but of questionable legality. The congressional hearings into the assassination of Dr. King bore this out. Two FBI agents testified before a Senate committee chaired by Senator Frank Church.
I'm trying to find out what it was that impelled some part of the FBI to pursue Martin Luther King with such an obsession. And what I understood that answer to be is, first of all, it was not any suspicions of the commission of a federal crime. None of the literature showed up a single suggestion that Martin Luther King had committed or was about to commit a crime. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, Senator, but at this point, much of what was being done did involve challenges to local laws. And there is a very strong suggestion that King was seen as rallying the lawbreakers and would-be lawbreakers, albeit for a cause that sounded pure. I'm looking now in terms of, if we look at what might have gotten the Bureau started, and if we remember at the same time he is extremely critical of the Bureau's own law enforcement efforts, we see throughout these documents and the New Left documents that it is taboo to criticize the Bureau and particularly the director.
Well, was he ever charged with fomenting violence? Did he ever participate in violence? Was it ever alleged that he was about to be violent?
That was the very opposite of his philosophy, Senator.
So that it was neither the fear of commission of a crime or the commission of violence. Was there any serious charge that he himself was a communist?
No such charge ever was made.
So that what was left then was a decision on the part of some persons or person within the FBI that he should nevertheless be pursued.
And replaced.
And the basis for that apparently was political. The decision that he was dangerous or potentially dangerous to someone's notion of what this country should be doing, and a further theory that the FBI possessed the ability to enter into this field and to investigate and to intimidate and seek to neutralize and indeed replace a civil rights leader that they thought to be politically unacceptable. Is that correct?
Yes.
Correct. All right. And the tactics they used apparently had no end. Microphonic surveillance of hotel rooms. They included informants. They included sponsoring of letters signed by phony names to relatives and friends and organizers. They involved even plans to replace him with someone else the FBI was to select as a national civil rights leader. Is that correct?
Yes, that plan didn't get very far.
But it was seriously considered, and Mr. Hoover penned a note to that suggestion commending its authors, did they not?
Yes.
Right. It also included an indirect attempt to persuade the Pope not to see him.
And many other people.
A direct attempt to persuade one of our major universities not to grant him a doctorate degree.
That's correct. After the March on Washington, there was an acceleration. He was defined because of his speech in that demonstration in Washington as the most dangerous and effective leader in the country, and there was a paper battle between within the Bureau as to how best to attack him, and he was attacked. After Time magazine named him as Man of the Year, again, the Bureau finds that reprehensible, believes it must attack and destroy. When he was given the Nobel Prize, again, they seek to discredit Dr. King with the persons who welcomed him back from that award. When he began to speak out against the Vietnam War, there's a new crescendo of efforts by the Bureau to discredit and destroy Dr. King.
It is my feeling that the assassination of Dr. King was a part of a conspiracy in the country, and I do believe that some individuals in very high places of our government were involved in this conspiracy. And it is the same conspiracy that eliminated and destroyed President Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and so many other freedom and human rights individuals.
I'm convinced the government was involved at some level. I will never separate the conduct, the attitude of Hoover and the FBI from Dr. King's assassination. I never will do that.
I think one of the most important things that come out in that investigation was that Martin Luther King in Memphis was in a white hotel, and the FBI admitted that they leaked to the press that Dr. King was staying in a white hotel instead of a black hotel, and it was that embarrassment that forced Dr. King to move into the Lorraine Hotel where he was killed.
There are more questions regarding the FBI's role in the assassination of Dr. King. For example, why was Dr. King stripped of his protection just before he was killed in Memphis? Reporter Les Payne and myself interviewed police officer Ed Reddit of the Memphis Police Department, who told how he was mysteriously removed from his security post near Dr. King. However, later, his superior, Chief Holloman, denied doing so.
Why do you feel you were pulled away from your assignment of surveillance that day? Why do you think they pulled you away?
I think because whoever pulled the trigger, I could identify.
When there were complaints from somebody, did we reduce manpower at the Lorraine? Did we reduce manpower in
no.
the area?
No.
The attorneys general in 1965 had for 25 years authorized wiretaps in a fairly widespread fashion. This was just one. At the very most, the only thing I can think of that I would have done, but I didn't even do that, was go talk to Bob Kennedy and ask him about it. But Mr. Katzenbach, in whom I also had great confidence, without giving me the details, said that it was all right, that he had, that there were no, it was not being done anymore, it would not be done anymore, and that there was just nothing to worry about.
I think the issue is the neo-fascist police state mentality that pervaded the intelligence community, that is a danger to America to this day.
Malcolm X was kept under heavy FBI surveillance since he got out of prison back in 1953. As he rose to national prominence as the black Muslim's chief spokesman, he became aware that he was under close watch.
Our desire, our prayer, that we can have a peaceful, intelligent rally here this afternoon. But at the same time, we see that they have surrounded us with many of their own agents in uniform and out of uniform.
That surveillance escalated into the infiltration of the Nation of Islam. Personal frailties were played upon, jealousy arose, and Malcolm was ultimately ousted from that organization. This caused an intense climate of rivalry that set the stage for Malcolm's assassination in February of 1965.
He was really declared a hypocrite at the time.
and because of some of the things that he was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, may God be pleased with him, a strong position was really taken against him. The ministers began to speak out against the things that Malcolm was saying in regards to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, accusations that he had made about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He had accused the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, for instance, of fathering children and et cetera. And you must understand that at that time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to the Muslims then, was held in such high reverence as you would even think of any prophet being held in high reverence. And this is the kind of love and admiration that Muslims at that time had for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So when Minister Malcolm began to say those things, it was taken as an outright lie. I would say that, take for instance, one time in the Muhammad Speaks at that time, the newspaper printed a big article concerning the chief hypocrite. And it actually had a picture of Malcolm's head, you know, rolling or bouncing down the street at that time. And, you know, the way that picture is depicted, you know, he has little horns on his head and things like this here. So indirectly, I would say that a very, very strong position was taken against him.
Yes, he's immoral. You can't take nine teenage women and seduce them and give them babies and not tell me you're moral, and then tell me you're moral. You could do it if you admitted you did it and admitted that the babies were yours. I'd shake your hand and call you a man. A good one, too. But anytime you seduce teenage girls and make them be charged with adultery, make them hide your crime, why, you're not even a man, much less a divine man. So, and this is what he did. He took at least nine that we know about. And I'm not speculating because he told this to me himself. Yes, that's why he wanted me dead, because he knew that as soon as I woke up, I'd tell it.
Plan of action was basically what took place. Me and Leon, we took seats down in the front of the Audubon, became early. We would drift into the Audubon. If indeed there was a search, then we could never enter. There was no search, so we drifted in just like we had hoped to. Leon Davis and myself took seats down front on the left-hand side. Benjamin and William, who carried the sort of shotgun, sat right behind us, you know. And Wilbur sat somewhat in the back, or almost in the middle. And our plan was, as soon as the brother came out to speak, that Wilbur would throw the smoke bomb to make a distraction, and that William would fire his shotgun, and that Leon and myself, we would fire our weapons, and then just break for the door.
Hasn't Dr. King's assassination, a police superior has trouble with the truth. He tells reporters that two suspects were arrested at the Audubon. Later, official police reports say that one was arrested. Also, listen closely as the police official carefully handles the question about police on the scene.
We have two suspects in custody now.
Where were they arrested? Who fired the shot?
I wouldn't know that at this time.
Where were they arrested, sir?
One of these men was arrested on the street by one of our patrolmen close by.
There were no police at this meeting, were there, Inspector?
There were no uniformed policemen assigned inside this ballroom.
No uniformed police on the scene. Does this mean that police out of uniform were there? And if so, why didn't they take action? What were they doing there? This behavior pattern rings a bell of striking similarity with the behavior pattern of the CIA overseas.
The Church Committee produced cables, demanded and got cables, which proved it traced the CIA's plan to kill Lumumba. Sid Gottlieb got on a plane and went to Leopoldville. Headquarters sent a cable saying, use the poison. Gottlieb was couriering for the poison. Headquarters sent a cable saying, you have to use it promptly because it deteriorates. And they had a plan to try and get it into his toothpaste or give it to him in a Mickey at some social function. And then there's a gap, and no cables, no explanation of what happened. Then 5 weeks later, he's beaten to death on an airplane. And unfortunately, though, the airplane was in the control of people who had agency cryptonyms. And the gap of what happened has never been answered. The men who were involved and were responsible obviously aren't speaking out, and there's no paper to prove anything.
So perhaps the same tactics were used against the civil rights movement. Heavy infiltration of the ranks, spread the seeds of dissension, then step back and let the blood spill.
As I see it, Mr. Chairman, it is for this committee to be able to figure out how to persuade the people of this country that indeed it did go on, and how shall we ensure that it never happen again. But it will happen repeatedly unless we can bring ourselves to understand and accept that it did go on. And I say that as one who worked as a United States attorney with the Bureau and have enormous respect for its capacities in the field of kidnapping, bank robbery, and a lot of other things, but am appalled to learn what the, if it's correct, the intelligence side of that Bureau was up to for so long.
If we would like to believe that the FBI would do all this viciousness and all of these things to an individual and would stop short of killing him, then we're out of our mind. In America today, if we believe the CIA would deal with foreign assassinations and would not consider it at home, that's like saying the mafia runs crooked gambling tables in South America, but honest ones in America. It just ain't true.
We've seen then how the decade of struggle ended. Many of the prominent figures like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were assassinated amidst an intense climate of hatred that government agencies were acutely aware of. In fact, the FBI contributed to creating the climate of hate. Moreover, the assassinations themselves appear to have been facilitated by an elaborate network of government and police agencies who were watching very closely every move that Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were making. And then at the same time, they disappeared just as the assassinations occurred. But those were the leaders. What about the students, the troops of the movement? Well, they too were subjected to harassment. This document that you're looking at now shows how the FBI tried to divide factions within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the Black Panther Party was also subjected to heavy, heavy surveillance.
We knew the history of the FBI's infiltration tactics in other organizations, particularly the American Communist Party. There was already a record compiled that showed that the FBI was even in charge of various branches of the Communist Party. So we understood that police tactic of infiltration. There was a situation where, in a sense, the white racism was its own victim. Like, for racist reasons, J. Edgar Hoover had not recruited black agents. He had a lot of white agents. And it takes time to train some black agents. In the meantime, those white agents, try as they might, were not able to infiltrate our ranks because The Black Panther Party did not have any white members, okay? And we relied upon people that we knew. And we kept people that we didn't know on another level. And I think this is why we didn't suffer more, put it that way, because they did catch up and start a crash program of recruiting black agents, and they very quickly filled that gap, but it took them about a year to do it.
In the summer of 1978, I interviewed a man who worked as an informer for the FBI during the 1960s. His name is Dothard Perry, also known as Ed Riggs, also known as Bill Perry, also known as Othello.
How were you paid?
The pay was always in cash. Cash, and you would sign a card. It would go like this. A rendezvous or a drop-off point would be picked out either by yourself or the agent. You would meet the agent there. Usually it would be in a vehicle. You get in the vehicle, he would hand you the money. He would tell you first to count the money. He would tell you the amount while you counted it. If the amount was there, he would then bring out a card. On that card would be for the week of such and such. In other words, the week was dated. So-and-so has been paid the amount of. Then you would sign the card, and then the agent would sign the card. The reason for this is that if all of a sudden the IRS became very interested about where you were getting all this extra money from, you could always tell them to go back to the Bureau, and the Bureau would have your cards on file.
I see. Were there such things as bonuses?
Oh, yes.
What were they paid for?
Bonuses were paid for, suppose while you were meeting with, or you were at a meeting with Bobby Seale's, Chulai of the Red Army happened to come to the meeting too, which is something which would be a new development. That's bonus time.
In other words, a hot piece of information.
Hot piece, very hot piece.
Did you ever suffer pangs of conscience?
Quite a few times. Quite a few times. I still suffer pangs of conscience. I suffer from the fact that a lot of people trusted me, and I misused that trust. I suffer from the fact that a lot of information that I gave out was the undoing of certain groups or certain people. I suffer from the fact that I'm on the run constantly. I have no real life to speak of.
You have no family life, really? You have a wife?
No, I don't have a wife. I do have a child. I can't see her that often. I have to stay away from them because once I come around, the Bureau shows up and harassment starts. I have very few close personal friends, no one to really confide in. It's like being on the outside of a glass jar and everything is happening inside the jar, but you're on the outside. You can see it happening, but you can't participate.
Why have you decided to talk to me?
For the simple reason, I think this information should be put out to the public. I think not only black people, but everyone should become aware of what your so-called law enforcement agencies do to so-called enforce the law. Because between you, myself, and the audience, I've seen more felons in law enforcement than I have in prison.
Many would say, well, look, you yourself just got through saying that the DLA was involved in criminal activity. What's wrong with wanting to put them in prison? How would you answer them?
I would answer them this way. first off, we have to understand why they did what they did. But I'm not even going to go off into that psychological hoo-ha. What I'm going to say is, when you become just as bad as the people that you go after, then there's nothing gained and a whole lot lost.
You also were active in the infiltration of many cultural groups. Before we go into that step by step, how much research and study did the FBI engage in of black culture in the late 60s?
A great amount.
Give me an idea.
From the thing is, they have a file on every type of magazine that blacks read. They have a file on the music.
Music?
Music, dance, theater, actors, comedians, you name it, man.
And they would actually study these different...
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
What would they do with music?
To understand the people, you have to understand the culture. To infiltrate, you have to understand. You had a lot of so-called white liberals that were infiltrating the so-called black groups using the information that they had gathered from the studies of blacks.
You mean just to understand the behavior pattern of our people?
Oh, yeah. I can, Will Heaton could name out some jams of Miles Davis that I hadn't even heard of. He could name off some books that I hadn't even read pertaining to black culture.
Do you ever see agents actually studying music of...
Yes, yes. Yes, I've seen them going over even video portion of cultural events. The understanding, like when, okay, you have an organization like Leroy Jones Black House. You remember that. Okay, Leroy Jones's place, which was done on the thing of tribalism. That's where I first heard the word Kintu, Mantu, Huntu, Hintu. These words of the African continuum. I learned that from an agent. He ran it down to me. They make in-depth studies of the personalities of the people they're dealing with, too, culturally. It always helps. It's a thing of, you can take their culture and use it against them.
How large would you say an extensive collection on our culture would you say the FBI has? Would you rated as large as a particular library, like the Schomburg Library in Harlem, or...?
I would rate it better. I would rate it better, and the fact is that they go into details. Details that we probably would overlook. Will Heaton used to meet me in different places, you know? Will Heaton, that was one of my supervising agents. There is a certain bar in the Los Angeles area where people into black cultural things met, and Will Heaton used to meet me there. And he would go into very long and tiring conversations with some very articulate brothers about culture, African culture, and Afro-American culture.
Tell me about some of the cultural organizations that you infiltrated and what you did.
PASLA, Mafunde, Watts Writers Workshop, which they had...
Watts Writers Workshop?
Yes. Watts Writers Workshop, which was one of the oldest established black writers' workshop.
That place was burned down.
Yeah. The Bureau had it burned down.
How do you know that?
I know because I participated. I did the arson.
You burned down the Watts Writers?
Yes.
Why did they want it to go?
At the time, funding had been cut to the workshop, had been cut out, but it looked like there was a possibility of a grant being given back to the workshop. And if there was no theater, there would be no grant.
How did you do it?
Two cans of kerosene, Purex bottle, gasoline, and a flare, highway flare.
Why didn't you use more sophisticated stuff?
Oh, no. No. You're never overly sophisticated. It's too obvious. This way you make it look like, you know, maybe somebody in the neighborhood that got kicked out of theater at one time got mad and came and burned the damn theater up, that kind of thing.
But you were involved in this theater? I mean, didn't it get to you at all what you were...
Hey, man, that got to me a great deal. I love that theater. I built the stage.
You built the stage?
Oh, yeah. When I got to the workshop, the stage that had been... The original stage that had been built needed an extension on it. The original part of the stage was in terrible condition. They had no lighting system. I put the lighting system in myself. I put the stage in myself. And that was a stage, man. And that was a theater. It's a nice theater.
Who was the director of that workshop?
Harry Dolan.
Harry Dolan. Some very, very well-known artists supported that workshop, gave money to it.
Some very well-known artists came out of the Watts Writers Workshop. You know, Glenn Tubman, Yaphet Kotto, Sidney Poitier used to come down there and give a class. Sammy Davis Jr. used to come down there all the time. Quincy Jones used to come there and give music classes. We had our own 8-track studio set up for sound. We had our own sound room there.
Was part of your other activities and responsibilities to study the profiles of celebrities who were supportive of organizations?
Definitely, and especially, like I said, psychological backgrounds, weaknesses and strengths. Did he have a weakness for blondes? Did he have a weakness for money? Did he snort cocaine? Did he smoke marijuana? They even get into, oh, and that's one thing the Bureau loves, is their sexual background. They have files and files on different blacks, not only celebrities, but a lot of others, sexual activity.
What would they do with this information?
Oh, that's used as a weakness.
So they would feed these to these weaknesses?
Yes.
Did you see that happen?
Oh, yes. Doc Holliday, who is one of the leaders of the BGF, Black Gorilla Family, which is a prison gang in the California state prison system. Upon his release from prison, a certain sister made herself known to him at a nightclub, whereupon he moved in with her, and she picked up names, telephone numbers, information, you know, that kind of thing. That lasted for a good 3.5 months.
Was this an unusual thing, or did this happen often?
No, that happens all the time.
Did you yourself get involved in doing that?
Yes.
Give me an example.
There was a gentleman that was on trial in Los Angeles that belonged to the BLA that had been busted in a southern state for a bank robbery, but was brought with two other people to Los Angeles to stand trial for the machine gunning of a police officer in Los Angeles. I was supposed to worm my way into the affections of his sister and whatever it took to get the information that I needed as far as what kind of defense they planned to use as to turn this information over to the federal prosecution.
Did you do it?
I got the information, and thank God I didn't have to go through with the actual thing of sexual activity.
What do you mean, thank God?
The sister was rather unappealing.
How did you justify to the organizations in which you had infiltrated yourself that you were living on an $800 a week stipend or on an $800 a week standard of living when most of them were living hand to mouth?
Well, hey, brother, you know, I'm hustling, you know. I mean, hey, man, you know, sell a little this on the side, a little that on the side. You know, I get over, you know, that kind of thing. In other words, ain't nobody's business but mine where I get the money. So, you know, everybody took it for granted that I was possibly doing a little dealing on the side. That kind of thing. Hmm. Then also, everybody liked me for the simple reason that I would do things that I didn't have to do. I would go out of my way. You know, like Mafundi would have a pageant and they needed someone to do the sound setup for him. And I'd say, of course, I'll do it for you. You know, that kind of thing. I was very well liked at one time in the community.
Would you say to American citizens that this situation of surveillance and infiltration continues to this day?
Oh, yes.
On the dimension that you experienced?
Probably much larger by now.
Larger?
Oh, yeah. Let me put it to you like this. Each year, everything gradually escalated up more and more. So I figure when I left, it didn't stop escalating. As they say, one monkey does not stop anybody's show.
You mentioned Sammy Davis Jr., who at one time, it was reported, gave money to the Black Panther Party, I believe. Were you ever assigned to look into that?
Yes, I was told to try to get as close to Mr. Davis or to anyone in his office as I could. I used to go up and have real chit-chat, chummy-chummy conversation with his personal secretary, Ann, at the 9000 building on Sunset. And I used to bring a Porter-Pack video camera, and I used to go around and I would videotape the whole office.
You mean celebrities would be coming into his office and you'd film them freely?
Oh, yeah.
Didn't they question that?
I'm from the Ross Writers Workshop. Yeah, right on, brother. You know, that kind of thing. No questions asked. Same thing with the NAACP Image Awards. You know, they were very interested in people like Sammy Davis Jr. There was another black in Los Angeles that they were very interested in because, not Los Angeles, but in Sacramento, Nathaniel Colley, who's attorney for the NAACP. And I know Nat. And they wanted information on him just for the simple reason that he's an attorney for the NAACP, which makes no sense to me, but must make a lot of sense to them because they use the information.
You've been called upon to testify in Washington. Before who?
Before the Senate committee. I was called first to testify before the church committee. And I did go to Washington, D.C. I did testify to those people. And I want to say right now that the committee was full of smack. They got loads and loads of information and didn't even use it, didn't release it. I had tapes that I offered to them in evidence against the Federal Bureau of Investigation with conversations of me and my supervising officer. Where he's telling me to obtain certain articles for him by stealing. Don't get fingerprints on it. We can really use that. Did you take the weapons over to such and such? The Church's committee told me that they couldn't use the tapes because the tapes were gotten by illegal means.
What would you say about the composition of the committee panel that questioned you?
I can say that's for the birds, too, because the same people that I was talking about were the same people on the panel with the church's committee.
What do you mean?
When I came in the room to be interviewed by the so-called people from the church's committee, the representatives from the Federal Bureau of Investigations were also in the room.
FBI agents were a member of the church committee panel?
They were there with the investigators for the church's committee asking questions just like the church's committee. And see, this is another thing that I find fault with, and this is another reason why I am not going to Washington, D.C., is that, again, I have been asked to come again for the second time. I'm not going again for the simple reason that when I went up there with the idea that there were agencies investigating the Federal Bureau of Investigation, not the Federal Bureau of Investigation investigating itself.
You're on the lam, almost. Do you have a sense that you're going to be arrested and go to prison?
Oh, yeah, eventually. Eventually, when things come to a head, it has to. Has to be that way. No other way around it.
What would you say to citizens who sit and listen to what you've said and have a sense of frustration and helplessness?
There are some agents, the old line agents, that disagree with the tactics that were used during the so-called COINTEL period. But one thing I don't want us to jump off of is that people always talk about, they're talking about COINTEL now so heavily. I'm not talking about COINTEL. I'm talking about a thing called BD, which was better known as Black Desk. The Black Desk was set up for a simple thing of infiltrating black organizations and black groups, whatever.
Where was this Black Desk, or were there a number of them?
There were a number of Black Desks, but the head Black Desk was in Washington, D.C., controlled by Sullivan. And the...
Was he black?
No.
Mm-hmm. And what was the function of the Black Desks all over the country? I guess there were dozens.
The function of the Black Desk was to monitor activity, social unrest, revolutionary groups, cultural groups, and such in the black community.
And feed it into this central desk. And it still exists?
As far as I know, yes.
We've seen a number of investigations into the assassination of Martin Luther King. We've seen an extended police trial of the assassination of Malcolm X. What you seem to say substantiates what many black people say out on the street, that government agents or agencies knew that these assassinations were brewing and either participated in them or allowed them to take place.
It would behoove black people, it would behoove all people, really, to question so-called the cut-and-dry one lone assassin theory. The Bureau and other intelligence agencies are very good at conspiracies. They are very good at setting people up to be killed. They are very good at making innuendos so the person will be killed.
City police don't know about it because they have policemen in there. They don't let black people form anything without some policemen in there. And while I was in the black Muslim movement, over the black Muslim movement, many of the police who were sent to infiltrate us, they're black, would tell me, say, look, I'm a cop, but I have to come. They would tell me. I knew the Muslim movement was full of police. So don't you think anything is going down that they don't know about? The only thing that goes down is what they want to go down. And what they don't want to go down, they don't let it go down.
Something else was used against the students that drove the final nails into the coffin, killing the movement.
What stopped it, of course, almost dead in its track, and not by any accident, was a widespread and deliberately organized widespread use of drugs. The fact that a decision was made, and I think you, most of you familiar with the broadcast of the mafia defector who went on public media to declare what happened and outline in great detail the great plan of how to destroy the black youth of the nation, starting in New York. He said in a meeting 20 miles outside of New York City, the great decision was made. He said he didn't have to guess about it, and those who heard him know that I'm quoting him almost verbatim. because he was there. And decision was to concentrate the distribution of drugs on the black youth of the nation, starting in New York. Starting in New York, beginning in the elementary school, and that to punish, even on the pain of death, any of the distributors who invaded the white community or predominantly white schools. That New York and other large cities were to be divided up into districts. The district commander, black, was to be given any kind of car he wanted, Mercedes, Rolls Royce, anything, because this would be a part of the sales pitch. That blacks just love fine cars, and he'd drive around through the community in his fine car, and some of his key assistants, and he'd be identified, he'd be known, and that sort of stuff. And so the story's, I'm not going any further into it. But thus it began, and the spread over the country, and we fell for it. Now, one thing was important, that the thing to attract the blacks, more than any other thing, more than the drug itself. But to spread the word, have a number of key young people in it, and spread the word that this is the end thing. So that'll get them. Just say it's the end thing. And they'll brave the fires of hell to be a part of the end thing.
So that's our story of the decade of struggle. We put together this film to pay particular homage and tribute to the extraordinary young people of that era. And we give the story to our young people of today in particular, in the hope that they'll stop and think about much of the negativism that they're caught up in nowadays and try to understand why.
Fuck you, Trump. We'll see you on the streets. Am I disappointed? Yes. But am I surprised? Hell no.
It clearly shows what the country is made up of, what the country was founded on.
Darwin described the United States as a greedy, hypocritical, racist, white supremacist, evil, warmongering nation.
Donald Trump is just a symptom of a greater system that has basically f***ed up for my people for over 500 years.
To me, the United States was founded in violence, developed in violence, and violence is an American, U.S. American tradition.
The thing that's rattling around in my brain is all of this militarized police and the attacks and everything that's been happening happened under the Obama administration. And I can't help but question what might happen under a Trump administration.
Now we have a really strong enemy to organize against that causes us to say, hey, we gotta get our together.
HIV संक्रमितहरूलाई माया ममता र समाजमा सम्मानित जीवन जिउने वातावरण निर्माण गरौं।
यो उनीहरूको अपेक्षा होइन अधिकार हो।
रोगलाई तिरस्कार र बहिष्कार गरौं, रोगीलाई होइन। एचआईभी अरूलाई मात्र होइन, तपाईलाई पनि लाग्न सक्छ।
सकारात्मक सोच, स्वस्थ समाज अनि सही निर्णय नै सरल तथा सफल जीवन हो।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
I don't know more calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution
to honor indigenous sovereignty
and protect the land and water
for generations to come.
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more. Become idle no more.
This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Shays, UK, US backed Chilean government, and the refugees from CIA backed El Salvadorian death squads. James, welcome to Going Underground. The state-mandated BBC monitoring unit here in Britain tweeted or posed a question. Could Bolsonaro be a refreshing break from political correctness? It had to take the tweet down. What's your perspective on posing a question like that?
Well, the question is offensive, and it's actually obscene. And it's both offensive and obscene because Bolsonaro represents a break that has absolutely nothing refreshing about it. He represents a break not just from political correctness. He represents a break from democratic values, from the rule of law, from human rights, and from the core value of human dignity. He has supported torture. He has called for the mass elimination of political opponents. He has called for people to be killed. Thousands, he said, thousands more should have been killed during the dictatorship in Brazil. And again, these are not merely outlandish comments in a vacuum. They're comments from someone who lived through the Brazilian dictatorship, who knows what it means, and to a public in Brazil that is very much aware of what it means to propose torture, and to support military dictatorship and summary executions. It's a break from normalcy. It's a break from decency. There's nothing refreshing about it.
I want to get onto the torture, especially with your perspective as someone who's analyzed torture in previous decades. But it wasn't only the BBC. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, funded by the Trudeau government, said that Brazil's new president-elect is a right-winger who leans towards more open markets. This could mean fresh opportunities for Canadian companies.
Equally problematic. But look, if we look in historical perspective,